Welcome to the Delmarva Almanac. Each week we connect you to the best of Delmarva. I'm your host, Dana Kester McCabe. This week on our show, we'll hear about the Fiber Arts Center of the Eastern Shore. In honor of Halloween, we'll learn about Delmarva's history of witchcraft and witch trials. And naturalist Jim Rapp will tell us about wild creatures of the night in our region. The Fiber Arts Center of the Eastern Shore, or FACES, in Denton, Maryland, is an all-volunteer organization dedicated to the many forms of art that have to do with, as you might imagine, fibers. That is sewing, knitting, tapestry, and more. I recently visited the center where I saw one of their quilting classes in progress and talked to Amy J. Cox, who manages their gallery space. Here's what she had to say about the center.
Fiber Arts Center is an organization that is here to promote and educate people about the fiber arts in our community. It is a place for people to show their work, to learn more techniques, and a place for people to come and buy and support their local artists that are working in the fiber arts. It was started with a conversation between the Quilt Guild and the Caroline County Council of Arts. The Quilt Guild needed a place to show their quilts, and this building was becoming available as the town was renovating it for this arts and entertainment district. And so the idea was born, why not a fiber arts center? So instead of just quilts, we now are able to feature all types of fiber arts that the community is creating. It's nice to find so many people that want something like this in their community and are willing to give their time to make sure it happens. We tend to do exhibits that last 3 or 4 months, and then we also have other events throughout the year. I try to make sure we have all local artists from the Delmarva Peninsula, but also I'll go over into Annapolis and other areas to try and bring in as much creative talent as we can find. So I was like thinking about these artists that I had, and I was like, you know, that person does a lot of birds, but so does that person. So I brought together 4 artists who did a lot of birds, and we had a bird show. And I've done just a knitting show just by finding some local knitters. And then I've also approached quilt guilds, and they've done exhibits here. We also were really fortunate to do an exhibit of the alpacas. So we have a number of alpaca farms around the Delmarva Peninsula, and we got 2 of them that are local that are using their own fiber to make things that they sell. And they were nice enough to show some of their stuff here. And one of those ladies, she does all of her own processing. So she, you know, cleans it. So she was showing me the whole process, and it's all just done in her garage. And it's fabulous that this is happening in this area. So we've got some more quilt shows coming up. Quilts are really our popular thing around here. So I try to work with some of the local quilters to get those kinds of things in.
Quilting is more than just making bedspreads. It's a fine art in and of itself. It's also an important part of our American heritage. The Fiber Arts Center and other buildings in the region are part of a unique public art display that honors our local history. These are elegant graphic signs based on single block patterns that were part of quilts hung out on clotheslines to signal runaway slaves traveling the Underground Railroad in the 19th century.
The quilt blocks are along the Underground Railroad byway, so they're highlighting different parts of town and different sites that are related to the Underground Railroad and the Harriet Tubman byway, I should say. And we picked blocks that we felt represented what was happening with the Underground Railroad and the experience of African Americans in this area and a little beyond as they made their way north. So we're trying to use fiber arts to highlight the history of our area. And someone had the brilliant idea of using what are traditionally called barn quilts and putting them on historic sites. And it's been a very popular idea. And then we had a local quilter. She took all the patterns that we picked and made it into a quilt that we now sell kits for, so people can make their own version of it. And another local artist did a drawing of Harriet Tubman, and we put that onto fabric, and that's now the center medallion for that quilt kit.
Fiber arts may sound like something stereotypically feminine, but Amy told me how the Fiber Arts Center proves that stereotypes are meant to be broken.
Well, we actually did an exhibit of just men. It was called Men at Work, and one of my artists is a needle worker who was in a time when Rosie Grier was starting to do his needlework. He was inspired by his book, and he started to do it. Then we also have people that do the dyeing, and then we had another, I've had a male teacher in who did spinning. That's also a lot of men like to do the spinning part. And if you consider fashion a fiber art, which it is, there are lots of men that are in the world of fashion, and they are working in the fiber arts. So, people say that there is a gender thing, but it's really not. It's anybody can do it. And, you know, sailors used to make all their own clothes and do their own knitting on board. And, I mean, it's a long tradition of history in primitive cultures as well that men were expected to do the dyeing and the weaving. So it's only a recent thing that people really think it's women's work.
A sense of community is at the core of the center's mission. They work hard to create programs and exhibits that respond to the needs and interests of the surrounding community.
We do try to have quilting and sewing because that seems to be our popular thing in this area at this time. But we've done spinning classes in the past and knitting and crochet. So we're trying to have a variety of things. There's a teen sewing night because a group of teens came to the group and said, we would like this kind of thing. So we're trying to cater to what the community wants right now. Things like paper is also considered a fiber art. People make their own paper, but then you can manipulate the paper as well. You also have things like dolls and the doll houses and the things that accompany them. And then anybody that uses fabric and manipulates fabric in any way. So you're looking at leather, wool, and then there's all kinds of beadwork. There's just a plethora, and people don't realize how much fiber is in their daily life. So they tend to discount it as, I see a knitted crochet or scarf every day, so it can't be art. But it is, because it was handmade by somebody, and it's special, I think, because it is part of your everyday life, but it's still a work of art.
Amy's own love of design makes her a passionate advocate for this form of fine art that has come into its own.
My background is actually in the museum studies with a specialization of clothing and textiles. I have a degree from the Fashion Institute of Technology in that. I knew I loved history, but I also loved fashion and textiles, and it was just something I'd always done as a kid, where I, you know, sewed clothes for my doll and stuff like that. I worked and interned in some really great museums in New York and DC, and then life brought me to the Eastern Shore. And I found out about the Fiber Arts Center, and I was like, oh, interesting. And I called up and I was like, hi, I want to volunteer. And then here I am. I just showed up at the right time to be able to help this organization and for them to help me have a place in this community. I'm proud that I've opened people's minds to what fiber art is. There's so many times I've had to defend fiber art as an art, not only to the general public, but to the actual artist, that they don't realize that they're artists and that what they do matters and that it's important and needs to be seen and preserved and shared. So to me, that's, I think, the most important thing about a place like this, is that we get to all those people and let them know what they are doing is important and needs to be recorded.
The current exhibit at the Fiber Arts Center is called Avant-Garde. Artists Kathleen Dove, Judith Gunter, Lauren Lay, and Pam Phillips experiment with fiber in order to create new perspectives. The show runs through November 12th. Visit our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/arts, to see the video of this interview and some of the beautiful work being shown at the Fiber Arts Center. Be sure to stop by and see them in person in Denton, which is a really cool place to visit. Besides the Fiber Arts Center, this historic town can boast about cultural attractions like the Caroline County Arts Council's gallery, known as the Foundry, and the Denton Rural Life Museum. While you're there, get something delicious to eat at Harry's on the Green. It's time for our first break. When we come back, we'll celebrate the Halloween season with a story about witchcraft in our heritage segment. Delmarva Almanac is brought to you in part by the following towns where the arts are flourishing. In Maryland, visit Centerville, Denton, Ocean City, Princess Anne, and Stevensville. And in Delaware, visit Dover, Milford, and Rehoboth Beach. Visit our website for links to their galleries, eateries, and arts-related events. That's delmarvaalmanac.com/artstowns. Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe, and I'm so glad you've joined us today. With Halloween just a few days away, it's that time of year when we indulge in scary stories. Delmarva has many ghostly legends chronicled in books and now by tour guides across the region. We also have a small history of witchcraft. Here in America, our colonial laws against witchcraft go back to British King James I, who set severe penalties for anyone who practiced what was called the dark arts. It was a felony to make a pact with the devil or to cast a spell or curse. When English colonists reached our shores, they found the shamanistic practices of the native peoples here were what they considered generally benign superstitions, but witchcraft nonetheless. The Nanticoke Indians were known to be expert herbalists, famous for their love charms. They were also rumored to be proficient poisoners who supposedly could wipe out a whole community with a single dose of their diabolical concoctions. Nanticoke shamans who practiced benevolent white magic were essentially doctors dispensing folk medicine. Those who were practitioners of black magic were known as night travelers, since their rituals were usually accomplished after sunset. These were seen as evil beings who did not keep company with the rest of the tribe. It was said that the only way to be sure that a Nanticoke witch was dead was if they were buried with the clay jars that they stored their potions in. I didn't find any record of native people in our region being charged with witchcraft during the colonial era, though there were a couple of poisoning cases. At the same time, witch trials in European countries and their New World colonies led to imprisonment, torture, and many gruesome deaths, mostly of women and girls. The first witch trials in Maryland and Virginia actually happened just offshore at sea. Women on four different ships bound for our region were tried and hung as witches. The ship's crews believed that these women caused the dangerous weather they had encountered on their journey across the Atlantic. The first of these was a woman named Mary Lee, who was hung shipboard for witchcraft in 1654. She was followed by Elizabeth Richardson on board another ship called the Sarah Arkt. One of Elizabeth's fellow passengers on that voyage, George Washington's great-grandfather John Washington, was so appalled by the despicable act he witnessed that he brought charges with the colonial authorities against the ship's captain, Edward Prescott. Prescott blamed the incident on a subordinate and refused to attend his own trial, claiming he had more pressing business, the baptism of one of his children. He was able to get away with that because women in those days were only seen as chattel under the supervision of their husband or some other man. Elizabeth was likely an indentured servant with no one to defend her rights. In 1662, Lord Cecilius Calvert ordered each Maryland county to appoint four men to investigate charges of witchcraft and sorcery in their districts. Potential sentences included branding, enslavement to Lord Calvert, loss of land, cutting off a limb, and even death. But by the time the Salem witch trials had caused a panic about satanic activity in New England, during the 1690s, the governments on Delmarva had already become a little more enlightened. In fact, mid-Atlantic colonials accused of witchcraft did not wait to be tried for the crime. They sued their accusers for slander. Since most of those defendants were women, they usually had to have their husbands or some other man bring the matter to court for them. But it was a remarkable early step for women's rights to have testimony in their defense taken and believed. Magistrates wanting to prevent the madness they saw playing out further north made clear by their rulings that unless a plaintiff could actually prove that witchcraft was employed by a defendant, they would be held financially liable for their accusations. Many of those making the charges were in fact themselves women. In 1687, in Old Somerset County, Samuel Collins brought a suit on behalf of his wife against John and Catherine Robbins. Catherine was accused of telling people that Collins' wife had bewitched animals, causing them to be sick. Collins claimed the slander had put his family in danger and had caused them to lose money when their livestock would not sell. He won his suit. John and Catherine Robbins had to pay the Collins family restitution and submit to probation. You're listening to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kestrel McCabe, and this is a story about witchcraft on Delmarva. I didn't find any stories about anyone here on Delmarva who was tried, convicted, and executed for being a witch. The last witch trial ever held in Maryland was, however, a Delmarva resident named Virtue Viol from the town of Plain Dealing in Talbot County. In 1715, she was sent to trial in Annapolis after a quarrel with her neighbor, Eleanor Moore. They were both older and unmarried. Eleanor said that Virtue had cursed her tongue, making her mute. Virtue was acquitted of all charges. Several decades later, another woman from the town of Plain Dealing named Katie Coburn was rumored to be a witch. She was an indigent, elderly woman who had been allowed to live in a decrepit old shack on the edge of a wealthy plantation. People feared her because she had some sort of deformity. They claimed she gave people the evil eye. Long after her mysterious disappearance and presumed demise, there were rumors of her ghost haunting the area. The laws concerning witchcraft were updated in the period following the Revolutionary War. They no longer referred to the practice of witchcraft, but to the pretense of it. This made occult activities, such as conjuring and fortune-telling, acts of fraud rather than heresy. The penalty was public whipping and a fine of up to $100. Belief in folklore about witches continued for a long time here. People used rituals and charms to ward off evil. There was a late 19th century legend that a man in Dorchester County died when a witch turned him into a horse and rode him all night long. It was said that clay was found under his finger and toenails. This was supposedly the witch's revenge for the man refusing to let her borrow his horse. In 1892, two lady fortune tellers in Wilmington were charged with witchcraft after customers reported being conned out of their money. In 1904, in Sussex County, a man was charged with practicing witchcraft and sentenced to be whipped at the pillory. The Delaware legislature banned this form of punishment the following year. In 1950, another Wilmington fortune teller was charged with witchcraft for charging someone an exorbitant amount of cash to rid them of a supposed curse. The judge dropped the witchcraft charge after the state was ridiculed in the national press about the case. By 1955, witchcraft as a crime was one of several obsolete laws purged from Delaware statutes. Journalists continued to have some fun at the state's expense, saying witchcraft was now legal in Delaware. The state also drew unwanted satire in 2010 when Delaware U.S. Senate candidate Christine O'Donnell made a tongue-in-cheek TV ad saying that she indeed was not a witch. This was in reference to an unrelated admission on a television show that when she was a teenager, she had been interested in the occult. Like many counterculture activities, witchcraft probably has been practiced in secret all through Delmarva's history. And in fact, witchcraft is now known by many modern practitioners as Wicca, which is a revival and modernized version of the pagan earth religions of Northern Europe. Whether you like your Halloween witches scary and riding broomsticks, or nobly honoring nature with ancient Celtic harvest rituals, I hope your Halloween is a happy one. Since this year Halloween falls on a Monday, which is a school night, some communities here have trick-or-treater activities today or tonight. On either night, please be aware of children out on our area roads after dark. To find out more about this topic, visit our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/history. And now for some Delmarva dates with history for this time period. On October 21, 1878, during a rare late-season hurricane, a tidal wave decimated 35 miles of shoreline from Collins Beach to Woodland Beach in what is now Bombay Hook Wildlife Refuge. And on October 12, 1929, a massive wildfire began in the Great Cypress Swamp on the southern border of Delaware. It's believed sparks from a moonshine still started the blaze, which was then fueled by 5,000 acres of drought-stricken forest and bog peat. The fire lasted, despite firefighters' efforts, until it was finally put out by a series of seasonal rainstorms. It's time for another break now. When we come back, naturalist Jim Rapp will tell us about some of Delmarva's nocturnal wildlife. Did you know that according to the USDA, 14% of American households did not have a sufficient quantity of affordable, nutritious food for at least part of 2014? Please consider giving generously to your local food bank regularly throughout the year. Visit our website for links for your state, delmarvaalmanac.com/hunger. Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. Now here's naturalist Jim Rapp to tell us about some of Delmarva's creatures of the night.
Nocturnal animals have long been associated with Halloween. There's something about creatures that literally go bump in the night that frightens and amazes us. If you decorate your home for trick-or-treaters, there's a good chance you have an owl, bat, or black cat somewhere in view. Nocturnal animals are primarily active under the dark cover of night rather than during sunny daylight hours. There are many reasons why this behavior can benefit wild animals. In hot places, such as deserts and rainforests, it's cooler at night. If you eat the same food as another similar animal, your ancestors likely switched to the night shift to avoid competition. It's also easier to hide in the dark from animals that might be hunting you. Owls are the bird ambassadors for Halloween, and witches of mythology were often linked to these nighttime hunters. One Greek superstition believed that witches could turn themselves into owls, while others describe owls as messengers for sorcerers and witches. Think Harry Potter's pet snowy owl, Hedwig. More modern legends say that an owl's nearby hooting or an owl perched on a rooftop is a warning that death is near. But not all owl superstitions are bad. Some cultures believe that owls are good luck for farmers at harvest time. Delmarva's owls are secretive, but you can often hear and see them at dusk and dawn. Of the 18 species of owls typically found in North America, 8 can be found on the peninsula. Eastern screech owls and great horned owls are commonly heard and seen close to people in urban forests and rural backyards. Barred owls prefer Delmarva's wet, swampy woods, and barn owls often nest in man-made structures near open fields. The tiny northern saltwet owl migrates through Delmarva in late fall and can be found in the maritime forests of our barrier islands. Short-eared owls and long-eared owls also make appearances in winter, and snowy owls occasionally migrate through the peninsula and hang out on our coastal beaches. Owls are specialized predators with adaptations that help them hunt at night. They have excellent binocular vision and depth perception, but their large eyeballs are fixed in their skulls. To compensate, owls have super flexible necks that allow them to turn their head 270 degrees, which is almost a 360 degree full circle. Owls have extremely sensitive hearing. The feathered facial discs around their eyes and ears act like a funnel that amplifies sound. Most owl ear openings are asymmetrical, which allows them to pinpoint the exact location of that tasty mouse rustling in the grass. The leading edge of the owl's flight feathers is rigid and comb-like, while the other feathers are soft and fluffy. This combination muffles any noise caused by flapping wings, which helps owls surprise unsuspecting prey. If you are a small rodent or bird out and about on Halloween, you should be terrified of the owls lurking behind you. Bats are another spooky nocturnal creature we associate with October 31st. Bats are probably linked to Halloween thanks to Hollywood and the popularity of Dracula and vampire movies. In nature, bats are the only flying mammals. They number about 1,200 species worldwide, which is almost 25% of the total number of mammal species on the planet. Bats are critical to global agriculture because they protect and pollinate crops. More frightening than the bats themselves is a bat-killing disease known as white nose syndrome. Millions of North American bats have died from this fungal infection, which appears as a white dusting on the muzzle and wings. The disease causes a loss of body fat and scarring on the wing membranes. White nose syndrome can also cause the weakened bats to wake up during seasonal hibernation, which often leads to death. While wildlife biologists are studying the disease to help wild bat populations, no remedy has yet been found. Delmarva's bats are divided into two groups, the cave bats and tree bats. While we don't have too many caves on the peninsula, our cave bats spend their winters hibernating in man-made structures such as abandoned buildings and barns. They often form colonies to roost and raise their young in the summer. Tree bats tend to be more solitary, and they roost alone or in small groups under pieces of bark or in clumps of leaves. Some tree bats are known to migrate long distances during the spring and fall. Delmarva's tree bats include the eastern red, silver-haired, hoary, and evening bat. Black cats are another classic Halloween symbol for being harbingers of bad luck. Pilgrims of the Plymouth Colony associated black cats with witches and sorcery, and they actively persecuted and burned black cats. Apart from the friendly and not-so-scary black cats living in our homes, cats in wild Delmarva are very hard to find. Historically, eastern cougars and bobcats roamed our peninsula. The eastern cougar has been declared extinct in the U.S., but cougar populations in the West are believed to number around 30,000 animals. Sightings of cougars and other large cats on Delmarva have been reported, including a black panther sighting on Chincoteague in 2003. If these cats are living wild on the peninsula, they are most likely escaped pets. Bobcats are elusive, medium-sized wild cats with a distinct bobbed tail and a tawny coat with stripes and spots. They have tufts of black fur on their ears and spotted fur on their stomachs. Bobcats are predators and can jump 10 feet in the air to catch a bird in flight or a squirrel on a low branch. Their main prey includes rabbits, woodchucks, squirrels, mice, and birds. Bobcats are also known to eat old, sick, or young deer. Bobcat sightings on Delmarva have been reported in recent years, but none have been verified by wildlife biologists. They are found on the western shore of the Chesapeake Bay and in southeastern Pennsylvania, so it is quite possible that a few have made the trip south to the peninsula. Keep your ears and eyes open for owls and bats when exploring Delmarva. If you see a wild bobcat, take a picture and send it to your state wildlife agency. You may help document an animal that most believe has disappeared from Delmarva. It would be nice to see these ghosts of the forest hunting again on Delmarva.
Thanks, Jim. Well, that's all for this edition of the Delmarva Almanac. Be sure to follow us on Facebook or Twitter, and next week join us to learn more about our local culture and get connected to our natural wonders. We'd like to thank our community partners, the Friends of Delmarva Public Radio, and our underwriters for their help in bringing this program to you, our audience. If you'd like to become an underwriter for this program, visit delmarvaalmanac.com/support. Our theme music was provided by Brightside Studio. This show has been a Moonshell production. Thanks for listening. Until we meet again, may the rhythms and tides of Delmarva bring you good fortune.